Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
I've been on this podcast grind for so long, been hustling down here in this basement. Man, I don't even remember what my family looks like. I can't remember the last time I've seen them. That's the life of a podcaster. Always working, hustling, keeping the goal in sight. Hey everybody, how you doing? Jim, Indie Author Answers. How's it going out there? I would personally like to welcome each and every one of you to the middle of September. Welcome. Next week, September 22nd, is my birthday. Yeah, how about that? I'm of that age where I no longer celebrate birthdays, but I mourn them. But it's not so bad. Anyway, let's move on because this isn't really very interesting radio here. So let's talk about something interesting. Let's do a little tip of the week. And what I thought I would talk about this week is doing paperbacks. Because, you know, as an indie author, it's easy, really easy, to get our stuff up in ebook. It just takes actually a few clicks in Amazon. But doing paperbacks is a whole other game, and it involves quite a bit more effort. And so you may be tempted to say not to create paperback versions of your ebooks when you put them up. But I'm here to tell you that you should make paperback versions of your books, and I'm going to tell you why, even. And here's the deal. Even though probably if I have a book in paperback and ebook, I probably about 90% of my sales are going to come from the ebook version and only 10% from the paperback. And then for the books that I have in audio, the proportions are all different. But even though I barely sell anything in paperback, the number one reason why you should have a paperback is to make your ebook price look more attractive. You know, when you go specifically on Amazon and you go on and you have your ebook is, say, $2.99 and your paperback is $10.99, when someone looks at that ebook page, it's going to say, you know, the price $10.99 crossed out and show the ebook is $2.99 and say you save 67% or whatever it is. So that makes it look like your ebook is on sale, even though it's not. And that is like catnip to people, just to say, you know, oh, I'm saving money getting the ebook version. So that's the main reason why you do it. And also, there are markets, there are people, even though most of my paperbacks, I think, go to book clubs, and my dad always buys a bunch to give out to my brothers and sisters and other people in the family. So those are for you, Dad, and book clubs. But there are some people who prefer to read on paper, and if you're only an ebook, then you're missing out on a chance of that market. And that's one of the reasons why I've been branching out a lot more into audiobooks the last 6 months or so, but that's a topic for a different time. So I'm not going to go really far into the ins and outs of how it works. There are lots of great tutorials online, but basically you're just going to export your Scrivener file, because you're all using Scrivener, right? You should definitely be using Scrivener. You're going to export that out to a Word document. Then you're going to change the margins and the font size and the line spacing so that you get the right page count. Then the cover is a trickier thing. Now, you can, whenever you buy your cover, you can probably pay your cover artist a little bit more to create a wraparound version for you. And I used to do that, but now I do it myself, because one is that you're going to have the book formatted for paperback to the exact number of pages you need before you give it to your cover artist. And I usually don't wait until that far into the process to do my cover art. I'm usually doing my cover art, I'm usually contacting my designer and saying, this is what I want, round about the time I finish my first draft. So by the time I've edited, it's been to an editor, proofread, everything, done the final polish, I've already got the cover art, so I can put it up for pre-order or do whatever, you know, do my cover reveal, all that stuff, right about the time the book's done. And the thing is, the way I look at it is that since I'm selling so few paperback copies, the paperback cover doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to have the cover, it's got to have a spine, and then it's got to have an image on the back with some text. And I always throw on a QR code there. And I use Photoshop a little bit for some stuff, but I'm really not a big fan of it. I use paint.net. It's kind of like a light version of Photoshop. It can do layers and it can do effects, image manipulation. So it's like Paint on steroids, halfway between Paint and Photoshop. So I just drag in my cover art and then I add in a spine. And then I usually take some part of the cover, copy and paste it to make the back image and blow it up, then throw some text on there. It takes me maybe an hour in Paint.net to make something that looks pretty good. Since I'm not going to be selling hundreds of thousands of paperback copies, it doesn't really matter all that much anyway, and it saves me like the extra 70 or 90 bucks or whatever the cover artist would charge me to do a paperback wraparound version. Now, I would recommend if you're going to do audio, get an audiobook version of your cover art made, because otherwise you're just going to have to stretch it out and it looks like crap. Anyway, so that's all we're going to talk about regarding paperbacks. Now, let's get into why we're really here. And why are we here, you ask? Well, that's a good question. I'm going to answer that right now. We're here to read a chapter from The Problematic Virtue, my unpublished first novel, and then we're going to critique it, and I'm going to rip it to shreds. So that's what we're doing. Today we're reading Part 3, Chapter 14. We're about two-thirds of the way through the book now. Maybe more like three-fifths. I don't know exactly. We're more than halfway and not as far as three quarters. I know that for sure. Anyway, so what we're going to be reading today, part 3, chapter 14, a Brian chapter, has actually something that we has been long awaited that I've been hinting at and talking about. No, it is not the big plot twist at the end of the book, but it is something that I've been anticipating for a while. So without further ado, let's get right to it. The clothes in the industrial washer spun as the water churned in a repetitive circle. Brian watched it mindlessly as a meditation, while trying not to let the circular motion remind him of the wheels of the bicycle that belonged to the broken man that Brian had held in his arms while they awaited the ambulance. Instead, he tried to shift his focus to rehearsing the lecture notes for an upcoming exam in his world religions class. Brian's first trip to the laundromat since his dorm days became necessary when his washer at home gurgled and died. The repair tech would not come until next week. Washer and dryer access at home had been a luxury he took for granted. Now it killed him to have to spend $5 or $6 in quarters to have clean clothes, especially since this week would be lean money-wise. To make matters worse, he had forgotten the dryer sheets at home and now had to spend 50 cents on a single sheet so his clothes would not get static cling. In between the first and second quarter, the bell attached to the door jingled, and he obligatorily turned toward the opening door. The first thing he noticed was the iceberg tip of a tattoo poking out of the top of a shirt. The tall, beautiful brunette entered the room, supporting a laundry basket against her stomach. Memories kindled in him like fire to brush. The first and last time he saw her, the same night as his post-Commerce City conversation with Wiles. The same night that he, Alex, and Heather had scrambled over the back fence at Miguel's house in a frantic attempt to elude the police. That had been over 2 years ago, but with the image of this girl's face still so fresh in his mind, it could just have easily have happened yesterday. She walked right past him, either not noticing him or not caring. Echoes of the failed attempt with the barista at Starbucks flashed in his mind. He would do better this time. Tattoo girl appeared to be trying to insert a $10 bill into the change machine, and something in Brian stirred and instinct prevailed. He had to talk to her. He visualized himself speaking with her. Do it. Do it now. Do you need some change? I don't think that machine takes tens. She grinned at him. My hero, she said as she handed him the 10 for 2 fives. Brian blanked on the follow-up since his plans had not gone beyond the first line. He spit out the first thing that popped into his mind. Do I know you from somewhere? He said, even though he knew exactly from where. Probably Hoffman's ethics class. Tuesday, Thursday, the one in the stadium room. Brian blinked. He was in Hoffman's class, but he'd never seen her there before. Yes, I'm in that class. That must be where I know you from. I don't remember seeing you there. Megan collected her quarters and picked up her basket without responding to Brian's comment. He panicked. She was about to walk away. Another impulse took over and he started talking even before he knew what to say. So let me ask you something because I'm curious about what kind of person you are. Ethically, I mean. Megan smiled and walked toward the washers. Brian followed. Do you add the detergent in first, then the clothes, or fill up the water and then put them both in? I put the clothes in first. That's a decent start. Keep going. She wants you to talk to her. Outside the box thinking. I like it. Well, I do like to live dangerously, she added with a wink. She winked. The wink took him by surprise. This girl portrayed herself as so self-assured and confident, and every word and every movement oozed sexuality. Hard to believe that such poise was authentic. A laundry question, she said. Was that seriously the best line you could come up with? We're in a laundromat, so I guess I thought it would apply. I didn't have too much time to prepare. Do you need some more time to prepare? She said. He had started to get a sense that this girl was the feisty type. No, I guess not. It's a little late for that now. You can probably tell I'm not quite an on-my-feet kind of thinker. Megan laughed. Is that so? You seem to be doing good so far. My question for you is, are you going to ask me for my phone number? Mind blown. He had the sensation that he was falling, drifting through the air while standing still. Brian considered the possibility that he might be dreaming. I feel like I'm completely outmatched here. You don't mess around, do you? No, Brian, I guess you could say I don't. I'm not much into small talk. Brian felt a million tiny pins of heat behind the skin on his face, which meant he had blushed. How do you know my name? Oh, come on, I've seen you in class. I ask questions. It's not a big deal. Anyway, you got your whites and colors separated already or what? 3 hours later, with a perpetual smile on his face and a phone number on a carefully folded piece of paper in his wallet, Brian sat at the top of an unfinished staircase at the construction site across from his apartment complex. The platform at the top of the stairs overlooked what was most likely the new building's lobby, with large open slots for windows and skylights that allowed ample space to take in a wide-open panorama of the mountains for optimal sunset viewing. Below him, wooden frames sat atop freshly dried concrete. Happy just to sit and repeatedly dissect the conversation from the laundromat, her name bounced around in his head like a child on a pogo stick. Her slight southern accent made her name play more like Megan than Megan, however. He had not enjoyed this level of happiness in a long time, maybe in years. Nothing in the world matched a new crush. Nothing in the world could compare to the inherent possibility and hope that came with it. Lost in his romantic fantasy, Brian almost did not hear the shuffling of feet through the snow and the steps below him on the stairs. Brian looked up to see Wiles standing over him, holding a six-pack ring from which dangled two cans of beer. Wiles plopped down on the sawdust-covered floor next to Brian, snapped one of the beers from the ring, and handed it to Brian. Brian stared at the beer for a second before taking it. Wiles popped open his own beer and said, "Gonna get my ass all dirty sitting here. So we meet again, Connolly." He did not look at Brian, but kept his eyes up toward the mountains. Not a bad view. "I've decided that the short hair looks better on you, by the way. I always thought you looked like a damn girl with that shit laying on your shoulders like that. How did you know I was here? What are you doing here?" "Britton told me that you like to sit up here so you can think about your belly button. You never come over to my crib with him. He's over all the time, but I never see you. That reminds me, you ever see Heather anymore?" Brian shook his head. There was something strange in Wiles' expression, but Brian left it alone. "Is it weird me asking you this?" Wiles said. Brian did not answer the question, but instead opened the beer and had a sip, foul-tasting and lukewarm, but allowed Brian an activity other than engaging with Wiles. Wiles nudged Brian on the shoulder with a closed fist. "We used to be so close, you and me. What happened? You just dropped off the face of the earth. One day we were racing down I-25 tagging billboards with a paintball gun, and the next day you were just up and gone. I miss you, son. We should hang out sometime, like the old days." Brian had no interest in reconnecting. You don't call it a gun, it's a marker. What's that? You wanted to ask me something, I assume? Brian said. Wiles' cordiality and charm clearly hid some ulterior motive. Brian preferred that Wiles just get to it. Is there something I can do for you? Oh, right. Actually, it's something I can do for you. I don't know if there's a gentle way to say this, but I know where you're at with stuff, so it seemed like the right time. I know that the market for weed has been a little dry lately, so I came to make you that offer about the yellow again. Where I'm at with stuff? I'm not interested. Wiles groaned. Slow your roll, son. There's no need to be all testy. I just came here to talk. I already told you no. Thanks for the beer, though. Wiles drummed up his used car salesman smile. Come on, son, don't be like this. I need you. I'm having some complications with a partner of mine. I need somebody to smooth things over, that's all. No drama this time, I promise. Just meet some people and sling a little bit of meth. I'll make it worth your while. I don't need the money. I'm doing okay, Brian said. That's not the way Alex tells it. He said you said something about the financial aid mob. Look, I know you've been eating ramen noodles and drinking PBR. I know you ride your bike in the freezing motherfucking cold to save on gas money. College is expensive, son. All I'm saying is we can help each other out some. As much as you want, even. I'm flexible. There's a little bit of money to be had in selling grass. You know that. There's a lot of money in meth. You can say no and keep on living in the poorhouse with no money to buy real beer. Or you can just take my little promotion and get your bills paid. Does it sound so terrible? Wiles had Brian trapped, and he knew that Wiles knew it. He found the only weapon that could entice Brian and used it to stab him in the wallet. The beauty of today at the laundromat and his reminiscing afterwards was that for a few hours, financial insecurity had not plagued him. And now along came Wiles with a proposal that seemed he could not refuse. Meth practically sells itself. Your boy Britton is getting out of control, Wiles said. You could take some of that heat off him if you help me out. Alex was careless. That much had been clear to Brian. Threats aside, since Wiles said he needed Brian, Brian could get something that he wanted out of it. The prospect of making extra pocket money was not the lure that might bring Brian back into the fray. There was a less selfish goal that Brian had in mind. Okay, I'm in, but only on one condition, Brian said. And okay, there we go. That is part 3, chapter 14, Brian. And there was quite a lot that happened there. We had the long-awaited meeting between Brian and Megan, who finally connected after seeing each other like star-crossed lovers for the first two-thirds of the book. And then we have a little bit of a tense scene where Brian's at the construction equipment, and Wiles comes up and makes him the offer again. So let's go back through it, shall we? Yes, we shall. So when we start off, we start with an image in the first sentence. So I've talked about this before, but since the chapters are numbered, I don't think that it's necessary to start. I mean, the chapters are named, so we know whose POV we're in. It's not necessarily necessary to tell us whose head we're in right away, because we know because of the chapter title. In my fiction now, if I'm writing a book with multiple POVs, almost always the first word of the chapter is the POV of the character we're in for that chapter. And I try to, I've said this many times before, but I try right away to tell you whose POV we're in, where we are, and what that person is doing as soon as possible, within the first paragraph if possible. But here we start off with this kind of cinematic image of clothes in the dryer spinning in a repetitive circle. And Brian is watching it, and he's trying not to think about the cyclist who got hit the last time we saw Brian 2 chapters ago. So that's a good reminder that Brian saw something horrific. But if you notice, it doesn't come up again in this chapter. You know, we have 1,800 words here, and Brian has experienced this horrific thing. A guy died in his arms. And you would think that that would fuck him up a lot more, other than he's trying not to think about it while he's doing his laundry at the laundromat. So that's something to consider in your fiction, is that if a character experiences a traumatic event, it should affect them for a while, you know, or a technique that I've seen a lot of authors do that I think is effective is to skip ahead in time, because there's not a lot of great storytelling in showing someone grieve. So I've seen books, you know, about a parent who their child dies, and then the book skips ahead 2 years. And because probably what happened in that 2 years was a lot of crying and a lot of therapy, and mostly that's not good fiction. So you can skip a lot of that. But this doesn't skip ahead. If it does, it's a few days. I don't even know. But Brian should be a little more affected by this. Anyway, I'll stop talking about that. I'll move on. So then we have Brian going to the laundromat. So he's in the laundromat, and he's talking about why he's in the laundromat. Brian's first trip to the laundromat since his dorm days became necessary when his washer at home gurgled and died. So this serves two purposes. One, I had already written earlier in the book that a washer and dryer in a closet was one of the fancy amenities that Brian didn't think they needed when they moved into their fancy overpriced apartment in Boulder. So I had to have a reason why Brian was at the laundromat. He's at the laundromat because he needs to meet Megan. So what I could have done was I could have gone back and taken out the fact that that apartment had a washer and dryer, and then just made it so that Brian's been going to the laundromat regularly. But that might bring up the point, well, why hasn't Brian run into Megan at the laundromat before? So the fact that his washer and dryer at home aren't working gives Brian an excuse to be at the laundromat for the first time so he can meet Megan there, who's a regular. The way it's handled in this paragraph in this chapter is a little clunky, but it essentially gets the job done. Brian has a reason to be there. Megan is a regular there, apparently. And also, it shows that Brian isn't happy about having to spend money, you know, to get clean clothes and to buy dryer sheets, even though that the sentence about the dryer sheets probably isn't necessary, because we've already established that it pains him to have to spend money because he's poor, because being financially insecure is one of Brian's main problems and something that propels him through the story, why he sells drugs, because he needs the money. And then, dun-da-da-da, Megan walks in. And so if you notice, there's something that I had forgotten until I was reading this chapter just now. Is so she walks in and he doesn't know her name, right? And there's this terrible line here, memory is kindled in him like fire to brush. That's such a terrible, cheesy line. So then we get flashbacks of when he saw her first, the night that he and Alex and Heather scrambled over the back fence at Miguel's house in a frantic attempt to elude the police, in that run-on sentence there. But we established that it's been 2 years, helping to cement the timeline since he's seen her. But it feels just like yesterday because he was so attracted to that woman. So anyway, when he sees her, now remember, he doesn't know her name, so he describes her as Tattoo Girl. And this works just fine because we're in Brian's head. He shouldn't know her name. He doesn't know her name, so her name shouldn't appear in this text. But if you notice, in just a few paragraphs from now, I, the author, start referring to her as Megan, and I shouldn't do that. That's breaking POV because Brian doesn't ask her name. Maybe at some point in a previous draft, she'd said her name, because that's fine if he would have been like, oh, it's Tattoo Girl, she's so hot. Hey, what's your name? My name is Megan. And then for the rest of the chapter, anytime she spoke or did something, it referred to as Megan, because now that's information Brian has. So maybe that line was in there and then I took it out and then just forgot to change the references to Megan to something else after that. But so we have this kind of awkward, supposed to be cute romantic comedy conversation where she gives him the 10. He gives her She gives him the 10. He gives her 2 5s. So now she can make change. They start talking about where they know each other. None of this is particularly interesting. They're in the same ethics class. Then so Brian uses that to ask her about what kind of, you know, to further the conversation, asking her about what kind of person she is. And for some reason, Megan is super flirty with him. Now, we've sort of established that Megan finds him attractive, you know, like when at the beginning of part 3 in the chapter where she was eating at Noodles and Company and Agent Walker came over to her and propositioned her with narking on Wiles. Megan saw Brian across the street, and she was like, oh, there's that cute boy. So we know Megan is attracted to him, but she is very assertive in being flirtatious with him. And we know from way back in part one, in that completely unnecessary chapter where Megan had sex with Chris Wiles, if you remember at the end of that chapter, she said, do anything you want. So we know that she's sexual. She's not afraid to talk about it. But it does kind of seem, because all we've seen of Megan over the last, 100 pages of the book or so is that she hates her brother-in-law, Wiles. That's mainly the impression we've gotten of her. So even though we've seen those kind of character traits in her before, the fact that she's so assertive and so flirty with Brian feels a little strange. Like, there could have been maybe more with Megan that showed her, that set up how she was going to be when she came in contact with Brian. So it's not such a shock. And there's even a reference about it here in Brian's inner monologue where he says, this girl portrayed herself as so self-assured and confident. Every word and every movement oozed sexuality. Hard to believe that such poise was authentic. So Brian doubts that this is who she is. And so the reader is like, is it inauthentic? If it is, why? What do I know about Megan that would suggest it is or isn't authentic? And that's kind of confusing to a reader, probably. That would pull a reader out of the story. And so that line should probably just be cut. Brian should just been like, whoa, she's really assertive. And then he could either be intimidated by that or find it a turn on or whatever. So then the conversation takes most of this section of the chapter before the scene break. And if you weren't reading along with the chapter at indieauthoranswers.com and you were just listening to me read it, I apologize, because this is one of those chapters that doesn't translate into audio very well, because we have a lot of back and forth dialogue with little attribution, and the characters don't do. You can get away with that if you're good at differentiating the way your characters talk. If you want to know how to do that, read a lot of Elmore Leonard, because he is the best dialogue writer of all time. I've said that before. If you disagree with me, you're wrong, and that's all there is to it. Anyway, so they're chatting, and then Megan drops this bombshell where she's just like, hey, why don't you ask for my phone number? And if you are, if you've been paying attention, you're like, wait a second, isn't Megan married? Why is she giving out her phone number to Brian? And it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense then, does it? Anyway, then we have one other thing here before the scene break, which was an attempt of a beginning writer, that being me, to try to show something in POV that doesn't work very well, where it said, Brian felt a million tiny pins of heat behind the skin on his face. That works okay. Because the second half of that sentence is, which meant he had blushed. Now, if you're writing really great POV, you're not going to say, and then Brian blushed. Because if you're seeing the scene through Brian's eyes, he can't see himself blush. So describing it as a million tiny pins of heat behind the skin on his face, that actually works pretty well. Because if you were blushing, that's the sensation you would experience. But then I had to go overwrite it because I didn't trust my reader to understand what that meant, which led to the second half of the sentence, which meant he had blushed. So that's condescending to reader. It's not trusting them to understand what I'm showing there. Anyway, so then after the scene break, Brian is back at his apartment. He's all happy. He's got Megan's phone number. And we see the construction site again. And there are two paragraphs here describing the construction. And before, if you remember, at the beginning of part three, the construction was just a big hole in the ground and some equipment. But now we've got a staircase, we have the concrete, the foundation of the building, we have framing up. So now, I talked about this before, how the building is supposed to represent the passage of time. So we should, from that, get that a few weeks or a couple months have passed since they moved in. And I think that does a pretty good job, if the reader remembers what the construction site looked like when they moved in. It wouldn't hurt to have a little reminder here about how much the construction site has changed since they moved in, if there is a classy and unobtrusive way to put that in. So here we have in the next paragraph, we have a reference to Brian's being an accent collector, how Megan, if you remember, she's from Oklahoma. Her slight accent makes her name play like Megan rather than Megan, because Megan is how an Oklahoman would say it. I know I don't mean to be insulting. I'm from Oklahoma, so I can do that. I can talk about my people that way. Anyway, so he's just sitting there blissful in his happiness, and so, of course, something has to happen to interrupt his happiness, or else it would be really boring. So Wiles comes and sits down, and he's like, "Hey, what's up, Connolly? How you doing? You look better with your short hair," which is good, because it reminds the reader that Brian did have short hair, if that's necessary. I don't even really know that it's necessary that he cut his hair, but it's part of who Brian is, so it's good to remind the reader from time to time. And he's like, "Why don't you come over?" And then there's this really strange reference to Wiles saying, kind of out of nowhere, Wiles saying, "You ever see Heather anymore?" And what I'm trying to do here, because in the next line, Brian shook his head. There was something strange in Wiles' expression, but Brian left it alone. Because Brian doesn't know that Wiles was sleeping with Heather after Alex slept with her. And so I think that's what I'm trying to get across there, trying to remind the reader that that happened, even though it's not important to the story, the fact that Wiles slept with Heather. It was just something that I put in there to be shocking. Anyway, so here what we have, and this is sort of interesting characterization of Brian, because everything, one of Brian's major arcs of the way too many several that he has, is that he learns how to stand up to Wiles. But if you read the dialogue in this chapter, it would give you the impression that he has no trouble standing up to Wiles, because he's flat out rude to Derek Wiles throughout the whole chapter. He's like, "Is there something I can do for you? What do you want? I'm not interested," blah, blah, blah. So it seems like Brian has made a huge leap in his ability to stand up to Wiles, even though that wasn't my intention. Because, you know, I talked before about arcs and how you need to plot points along that line, along the curve where people change. Anyway, it would seem like Brian's done changing with his arc here, but he shouldn't be anyway, because we're only 3/5 of the way through the book. So Wiles makes his offer again for Brian to sell meth, and now he knows from what Alex has told him that Brian needs money. There's a reference to the financial aid mob eating ramen noodles, drinking PBR, Pabst Blue Ribbon. That Brian is riding his bike in the motherfucking cold to save gas money. So Wiles has figured out how to get Brian to do what he wants, to sell meth. Now, I don't know how you feel about meth. You know, maybe you're okay with meth after watching every season of Breaking Bad, like I told you to do several episodes ago. But there might be a lot of readers at this point who would look at Brian and go, you know, selling weed, that's maybe okay. You know, weed is legal in several states, even at this, in the year of our Lord 2015. But selling meth, that's bad. So some readers who may have been sympathetic with Brian, when they read here that he's going to start selling meth, they may lose a huge chunk of sympathy for him. You know, it works in Breaking Bad that they're dealing meth because you know about Walter's circumstances and you know why he's going to cook it. And it makes sense. It doesn't really make you lose respect or make Walter less sympathetic, you know. And I'm not going to go into Walter White's sympathetic qualities again. I've talked about it probably too many times in the show already. Anyway, so then we get to the end of the chapter, and this chapter has a good cliffhanger. This is one I'm actually pretty proud of, and I know that this is something that I added in later. Because what happens is we have Brian going, "Oh, I don't want to sell meth, but maybe I can get something out of it." And we have we do have Brian thinking about it a little too much and being vague, with readers going, "What is it? What is it? What is he going to get out of it?" And then the chapter ends with Brian saying, "Yes, I'll do this, but only on one condition." And that's a good cliffhanger. It's not the kind of cliffhanger like a bomb going off or opening the door and gasping to see what's there. Not like those cheap cliffhangers. But this is a cliffhanger in that you don't know what's going to happen next. Now, the way I could have also done it for Brian to say, "I'm in on one condition. Here's my condition." And then Wiles looks at him, and you don't know whether or not Wiles is going to accept it. that might have been even better, because it's not the sort of shocker cliffhanger where, oh, something's going to happen, cut to black, and then you don't find out what it is until the next chapter. But in the end, I think that this works pretty well, because it does drive you on. I mean, it makes you want to find out what his condition is. What's his condition? What's he going to get out of this that's so great that he would stoop to selling meth for his arch enemy, Derek Wiles? And with that, I think it's time to say goodbye. Don't be sad. I'll be back next week. I love you guys. Have a good September. Bye.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad. We will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste, so please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com, and you can even sign up for the email list, and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So go on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers, and you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it.